got the names. Maybe they were trying to protect us in some way, I said.
Thanks for showing me, said Nicole. But I don't think you should keep these around.
What if you get caught with them?
I know. I tried to put the pages back, but the file wasn't there anymore.
In the end, we decided to tear the pages up into small pieces and flush them down the toilet. Aunt Lydia had told us we should strengthen our minds for the mission ahead of us. Meanwhile, we should continue on with life as usual and not do anything to call attention to Nicole or arouse suspicion. That was difficult as we were anxious. I, for one, lived with a sense of dread. If Nicole were to be discovered, would Becca and I be accused?
Becca and I were due to leave on our Pearl Girls mission very soon. Would we even go? Or did Aunt Lydia have some other destination in mind? We could only wait and see. Becca had studied the Pearl Girls Standard Guide of Canada, with the currency, the customs, and the methods of purchasing, including credit cards. She was much better prepared than I was. When the Thanksgiving ceremony was less than a week away, Aunt Lydia called us to her office again.
This is what you must do, she said. I have arranged a room for Nicole at one of our country retreat houses. The papers are in order. But it is you, Aunt Immortelle, who will be going in Nicole's stead. She herself will take your place and will travel as a Pearl Girl to Canada.
Then I won't be going? Said Becca, dismayed.
You will go later, said Aunt Lydia.
I suspected it was a lie, even then.
Part 21. Fast and Thick.
The Ardua Hall Holograph. Chapter 59. I'd thought I had everything in order, but the best laid plans gang oftegly, and trouble comes in threes. I write this in haste at the end of a very trying day. My office might as well have been Grand Central before that venerable edifice was reduced to rubble during the War of Manhattan, so heavy was the foot traffic through it. The first to make an appearance was Aunt Vidala, who turned up right after breakfast. Vidala and undigested porridge are a taxing combination. I vowed to imbibe some mint tea as soon as I might arrange it. Aunt Lydia, there is a matter to which I wish to draw your urgent attention, she said. I sighed inwardly. Of course, Aunt Vidala, do sit down. I won't take much of your time, she said, settling herself in the chair in preparation for doing just that. It's about Aunt Victoria. Yes. She and Aunt Immortelle are soon to set off on their Pearl Girls mission to Canada. That is what I wish to consult you about. Are you sure they are ready for it? They are young for their ages, even more so than the other supplicants of their generation. Neither of them have had any experience of the wider world, but some of the others have at least firmness of character that is lacking in these two. They are, you might say, malleable. They will be overly susceptible to the material temptations on offer in Canada. Also, in my opinion, Aunt Victoria is a defection risk. She has been reading some questionable material. I trust you are not calling the Bible questionable, I said. Certainly not. The material to which I refer is her own bloodlines file from the genealogical archives. It will give her dangerous ideas. She does not have access to the bloodline's genealogical archives, I said. Someone must have obtained the file for her. I happen to have seen it on her desk. Who would have done that without my authorization, I said. I must make inquiries. I cannot have insubordination. but I am sure Aunt Victoria is, by now, resistant to dangerous ideas. Despite your opinion of her juvenility, I believe she has achieved an admirable maturity and strength of mind. A fin facade, said Vidala. Her theology is very shaky. Her notion of prayer is fatuous. She was frivolous as a child and recalcitrant when it came to her school duties, especially the handicrafts. Also, her mother was...
I know who her mother was, I said. The same can be said of many of our most respected younger wives, who are the biological progeny of handmaids. But degeneracy of that sort is not necessarily inherited. Her adoptive mother was a model of rectitude and patient suffering.
That is true as concerns Tabitha, said Aunt Vidala. But, as we know, Aunt Victoria's original mother is a particularly flagrant case. Not only did she disregard her duty, abandon her appointed post, and defy those set in divine authority over her, but she was the prime mover in the stealing of baby Nicole from Gilead.
Ancient history, Vidala, I said. It is our mission to redeem, not to condemn on purely contingent grounds.
Certainly as regards Victoria, but that mother of hers ought to be cut into 12 pieces.
No doubt, I said.
There is a credible rumor that she's working with Mayday Intelligence in Canada on top of her other treasons.
We win some, we lose some, I said.
That is an odd way of putting it, said Aunt Vidala. It is not a sport.
It is kind of you to offer me your observations, unacceptable speech, I said. As for your insights on Aunt Victoria, the proof will be in the pudding. I am sure she will complete her Pearl Girl's assignment most satisfactorily. We shall see, said Aunt Vidala with a half-smile. But if she defects, kindly remember that I warned you. Next to arrive was Aunt Helena, all a puff from limping over from the library. Increasingly, her feet are a bother to her.
Aunt Lydia, she said, I feel you should be aware that Aunt Victoria has been reading her own bloodlines file from the genealogical archives without authorization. I believe that, in view of her biological mother, it is most unwise.
I have just been informed of this fact by Aunt Vidala, I said. She shares your view as to the feebleness of Aunt Victoria's moral fiber. But Aunt Victoria was well brought up and has had the best education at one of our prime Vidala schools. Is it your theory that nature will win out over nurture? In which case the original sinfulness of Adam will assert itself in all of us despite our rigorous efforts to stamp it out, and I am afraid our Gilead project will be doomed.
Oh, surely not. I didn't mean to imply that, Helena said, alarmed.
You've read Agnes Jemima's bloodlines file yourself? I asked her.
Yes, many years ago. It was restricted at that time to the founding aunts.
We made the correct decision. Had the knowledge that baby Nicole was Aunt Victoria's half-sister been widely disseminated, it would have been detrimental to her development as a child. I now believe that some of the more unscrupulous within Gilead might have attempted to use her as a bargaining chip in their attempts to retrieve baby Nicole, had they been aware of the relationship.
I had not thought of that, said Aunt Helena. Of course you are right.
It may interest you to know, I said, that Mayday is cognizant of the sisterly relationship. They have had baby Nicole within their grasp for some time. It is thought they may wish to reunite her with her degenerate mother, since her adoptive parents have died suddenly. In an explosion, I added. Aunt Helena twisted her claw-like little hands.
Mayday is ruthless. They would think nothing of placing her in the care of a moral criminal such as her mother, or even of sacrificing an innocent young life.
Baby Nicole is quite safe, I said. Praise be, said Aunt Helena. Though she is as yet ignorant of the fact that she is baby Nicole, I said. But we hope soon to see her take her rightful place in Gilead. There is now a chance.
I rejoice to hear it.
But should she indeed arrive among us, we must proceed carefully in the matter of her true identity, said Aunt Helena. We must break it to her gently. Such revelations can destabilize a vulnerable mind. My thoughts exactly. But in the meantime, I would like you to observe the movements of Aunt Vidala. I fear it is she who has placed the bloodlines file in the hands of Aunt Victoria. To what end, I can't imagine. Possibly she wishes Aunt Victoria to be overwhelmed with despair at the news of her degenerate parentage and be thrown into an unsettled spiritual state and make some rash misstep. Vidala never liked her, said Aunt Helena, even when she was at school. She limped away, happy to have been given a commission. As I was sitting in the Schlafly Café, having my late afternoon cup of mint tea, Aunt Elizabeth hurried in. Aunt Lydia, she wailed, there have been eyes and angels in Ardua Hall. It was like an invasion. You didn't sanction this? Calm yourself, I said. My own heart was beating fast and thick. Where exactly were they? In the print shop. They confiscated all our Pearl Girls' brochures. Aunt Wendy protested, and I am sorry to say she was arrested. They actually laid hands on her. She shuddered. This is unprecedented, I said, rising to my feet. I shall demand a meeting with Commander Judd immediately. I headed for my office, intending to use the red direct-line telephone, but there was no need. Judd was there before me. He must have simply barged in, pleading an emergency. So much for our agreed-on sacred separate sphere. Aunt Lydia, I felt an explanation of my action was in order, he said. He was not smiling. I am sure there is an excellent one, I said, allowing a little coldness into my voice. The eyes and angels have greatly overstepped the bounds of decency, not to mention those of custom and law. All in the service of your good name, Aunt Lydia. May I sit down? I gestured to the chair. We sat. After a number of dead ends, we came to the conclusion that the microdots I informed you about must have been passed to and fro between Mayday and an unknown contact here in Ardua Hall through the unwitting agency of the brochures that the Pearl Girls were distributing. He paused to note my response. You astonish me, I said. What effrontery! I was wondering what had taken them so long. But then microdots are very small, and who would think to suspect our attractive and orthodox recruiting materials? No doubt the eyes wasted a lot of time inspecting shoes and undergarments. Do you have proof, I asked, and if so, who was the rotten apple in our barrel? We raided the Ardua Hall print shop and retained Aunt Wendy for questioning. It seemed the most direct path to the truth. I cannot believe Aunt Wendy is implicated, I said. That woman is incapable of devising such a scheme. She has the brain of a guppy. I suggest you release her immediately. So we have concluded. She will recover from the shock in the Calm Embalm Clinic, he said. That was a relief to me. No pain unless necessary, but if necessary, pain. Aunt Wendy is a useful idiot, but harmless as a pea. What did you discover? I said. Were any of these microdots, as you call them, on those brochures that had been newly printed? No, though an inspection of brochures recently returned from Canada yielded several dots containing maps and other items that must have been appended to them by Mayday. The unknown traitor within us must have realized that the elimination of the clotheshound end of the operation has rendered that pathway obsolete and has ceased to ornament the Pearl Girls' brochures with classified information from Gilead. I have long had my doubts about Aunt Vidala, I said. Aunt Helena and Aunt Elizabeth also have clearance for the print shop, and I myself have always been the one to place the new brochures in the hands of our departing Pearl Girls. So I ought to be under suspicion as well. Commander Judd smiled at that. Aunt Lydia, you must have your little jokes, he said. Even at a time like this, others had access as well, there were several apprentice printers, but there is no evidence of wrongdoing on any of their parts, and a substitute culprit will not do in this case. We must not leave the actual perpetrator at large. So we remain in the dark. Unfortunately, very unfortunately for me, and thus very unfortunately for you as well, Aunt Lydia, my stock is falling rapidly with the council. I've been promising them results. I sense the cold shoulders, the abrupt greetings. I detect the symptoms of an imminent purge. Both you and I will be accused of laxness to the point of treachery, for letting May Day run rings around us, right under our noses here in Ardua Hall. The situation is critical, I said. There's a way to redeem ourselves, he said. Baby Nicole must be produced immediately and put on full display. Television, posters, a large public rally. I can see the virtue of that, I said. It would be even more efficacious if I could announce her betrothal to myself and have the subsequent wedding ceremony broadcast. You and I would be untouchable then. Brilliant, as usual, I said, but you are married. How is the health of my wife, he asked, raising his eyebrows reproachfully. Better than it was, I said, but not as good as it might be. How can he have been so obvious as to have employed rat poison? Even in small quantities, it is so easily detectable. Dislikable though Shunammite may have been as a schoolgirl, I have no wish to have her join Judge Bluebeard's chamber of defunct brides. She is in fact making a recovery. However, her terror at the prospect of returning to the loving arms of Judd is impeding her progress. I fear she will have a relapse, I said. He sighed. I will pray for her release from suffering, he said. And I'm sure your prayers will be answered soon. We gazed at each other across my desk. How soon? He could not resist asking. Soon enough, I said.
Part 22. Heartstopper.
Transcript of Witness Testimony 369A. Chapter 60. 2 days before Becca and I were supposed to receive our strands of pearls, we had an unexpected visit from Aunt Lydia during our private evening prayers. Becca opened the door.
Oh, Aunt Lydia,
she said with some dismay.
Praise be.
Kindly step back and shut the door behind me, Aunt Lydia said. I'm in a hurry. Where is Nicole?
Upstairs, Aunt Lydia, I said. While Becca and I did our praying, Nicole usually left the room and went off to practice her physical exercises.
Please call her. There is an emergency, said Aunt Lydia.
She was breathing more quickly than usual.
Aunt Lydia, are you well?
Becca asked anxiously.
Would you like a glass of water?
Don't fuss, she said.
Nicole came into the room. Everything okay? She asked.
In point of fact, no, said Aunt Lydia. We find ourselves in a tight corner. Commander Judd has just raided our printing press in search of treachery. Though he caused considerable distress to Aunt Wendy, he found nothing incriminating. But unfortunately, he has learned that Jade is not Nicole's true name. He has discovered that she is baby Nicole, and is determined to marry her as soon as possible in order to increase his own prestige. He wishes the wedding to take place on Gilead television.
Triple shit, said Nicole.
Language, please, said Aunt Lydia.
They can't make me marry him, said Nicole.
They'd do it somehow, said Becca. She'd turned very pale.
This is terrible, I said.
From the file I'd read on Commander Judd, it was worse than terrible. It was a death sentence. What can we do?
You and Nicole must leave tomorrow, said Aunt Lydia to me, as early as possible. A Gilead diplomatic plane will not be possible. Judd would hear of it and stop it. You'll have to take another route.
But we aren't ready, I said. We don't have our pearls, or the dresses, or the Canadian money, or the brochures, or the silver backpacks.
I will bring the necessary items to you later tonight, said Aunt Lydia. I have already arranged a pass identifying Nicole as Aunt Immortelle. Unfortunately, there will not be time for me to reschedule the sojourn at the retreat house for Aunt Immortelle. Such a deception might not have lasted long enough in any case.
Aunt Helena will notice Nicole is gone, I said. She always counts heads. And they'll wonder why Becca, why Aunt Immortelle is still here.
Indeed, said Aunt Lydia. Therefore, I must ask you to perform a special service, Aunt Immortelle. Please conceal yourself for at least 48 hours after the other two have left. Perhaps in the library?
Not there, said Becca. There are too many books. There isn't room for a person.
I'm sure you'll think of something, said Aunt Lydia. Our entire mission, not to mention the personal safety of Aunt Victoria and Nicole, depends on you. It is a great deal of responsibility. A renewed Gilead can be possible only through you, and you would not want the others to be caught and hanged.
No, Aunt Lydia, Becca whispered.
Thinking cap on, said Aunt Lydia brightly. Use your wits.
You're dumping too much on her, said Nicole to Aunt Lydia. Why can't I just go alone? Then Aunt Immortelle and Agnes, Aunt Victoria, can make their trip together at the right time.
Don't be stupid, I said. You can't. You'd be arrested immediately. Pearl girls always go in twos. And even if you don't wear the uniform, a girl your age would never travel unaccompanied.
We should make it look as if Nicole has climbed over the wall, said Becca. That way, they won't look inside Ardua Hall. I'll have to hide inside it somewhere.
What an intelligent idea, Aunt Immortelle, said Aunt Lydia. Perhaps Nicole will oblige us by writing a note to that effect. She can say that she realizes she is unsuitable as an aunt. That will not be hard to believe. Then she can claim to have run off with an economan, some lowly functionary doing repair work for us here, who has promised her marriage and a family. Such an intention would at least demonstrate an admirable desire to procreate.
As if. But no problem, said Nicole.
No problem what? Aunt Lydia said crisply.
No problem, Aunt Lydia, said Nicole. I can write the note. At 10 o'clock, when it was dark, Aunt Lydia reappeared at the door, carrying a bulky black cloth bag. Becca let her in. Blessed be, Aunt Lydia, she said. Aunt Lydia didn't bother with a formal greeting.
I've brought everything you'll need. You will leave by the east gate at 6:30 a.m. precisely. There will be a black car waiting for you to the right of the gate. You will be driven out of this city as far as Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where you will take a bus. Here's a map with the route marked. Get off at the X. The passwords there will be May Day and June Moon. The contact there will take you to your next destination. Nicole, If your mission is successful, those who murdered your adoptive parents will be revealed, if not held to account immediately. I can now tell both of you that if you do in fact reach Canada, despite known obstacles, there is a not insignificant chance that you may, I say may, be reunited with your mother. She has been aware of that possibility for some time.
Oh, Agnes, praise be, that would be so wonderful, Becca said in a small voice. For both of you, she added.
I'm truly grateful to you, Aunt Lydia, I said. I have prayed so long for such an outcome.
I said, if you're successful. It's a big if, said Aunt Lydia. Success is not a foregone conclusion. Excuse me.
She looked around, then sat down heavily on the sofa.
I will trouble you for that glass of water now.
Becca went to get it. Are you all right, Aunt Lydia? I asked.
The minor infirmities of age, she said. I hope you will live long enough to experience them. One more thing. Aunt Fadala is in the habit of taking an early morning walk in the vicinity of my statue. If she sees you, dressed as Pearl Girls, as you will be, she will attempt to stop you. You must act quickly, before she can create a disturbance.
But what should we do? I asked.
You are strong, said Aunt Lydia, looking at Nicole. Strength is a gift. Gifts should be employed.
You mean I should hit her? Said Nicole.
That is a very direct way of putting it, said Aunt Lydia.
After Aunt Lydia had gone, we opened the black cloth bag. There were the two dresses, the two sets of pearls, the two white hats, the two silver backpacks. There was a packet of brochures and an envelope with some Gilead food tokens, a bundle of Canadian paper money, and two credit cards. There were two passes to get us through the gates and checkpoints. There were also two bus tickets.
Guess I'll write that note and go to bed, said Nicole. See you in the AM.
She was acting brave and unconcerned, but I could see she was nervous. Once she was out of the room, Becca said,
I really wish I was going with you.
I really wish you were coming too, I said. But you'll be helping us. You'll be protecting us. And I'll find a way to get you out later, I promise.
I don't think there is a way, said Becca. But I pray you are right.
Aunt Lydia said 48 hours. That means only 2 days if you can hide that long.
I know where, said Becca. On the roof, in the water cistern.
No, Becca, that's too dangerous.
Oh, I'll let all the water out first, she said. I'll run it through the doorway sea bathtub.
They'll notice, Becca, I said. In the A and B doorways, if there isn't any water, they share our cistern.
They won't notice at first. We're not supposed to take baths or showers that early in the day.
Don't do it, I said. Why don't I just not go?
You don't have a choice. If you stay here, what will happen to Nicole?
And Aunt Lydia wouldn't want them interrogating you and making you tell about what she's planned. Or else Aunt Fadala would want to question you, and that would be the end.
Are you saying she'd kill me?
Eventually.
Or someone would, said Becca. It's what they do.
There must be a way we can take you, I said. We can hide you in the car, or...
Pearl girls only ever travel in twos, she said. We wouldn't get far.
I'll be with you in spirit. Thank you, Becca, I said. You are a sister to me. I'll think of you as birds flying away, she said. A bird of the air will carry the voice. I will pray for you, I said. It did not seem adequate. And I for you. She smiled slightly. I've never loved anyone but you. I love you too, I said. Then we hugged each other and cried a little. Get some sleep, Becca said. You will need your strength for tomorrow. You too, I said. I will stay up, she said. I'll do a vigil for you. She went into her room, closing the door softly. Chapter 61. The next morning, Nicole and I slipped quietly out of doorway C. The clouds in the east were pink and gold. The birds were chirping. The early morning air was still fresh. There was no one else about. We walked quickly and quietly along the pathway in front of Ardua Hall, towards the statue of Aunt Lydia. Just as we got to it, Aunt Vidala came around the corner of the adjacent building, walking resolutely. Aunt Victoria, she said. Why are you wearing that dress? The next Thanksgiving isn't until Sunday. She peered at Nicole. And who is that with you? That's the new girl, Jade. She isn't supposed to. She reached out her hand and grabbed Nicole's strand of pearls, which broke. Nicole did something with her fist. It was so fast, I hardly saw it, but she hit Aunt Vidala in the chest. Aunt Vidala crumpled to the ground. Her face was pasty white, her eyes were closed. Oh no, I began to say. Help me, said Nicole. She took Aunt Vidala by the feet and dragged her behind the base of the statue. Fingers crossed, she said. Let's go. She took me by the arm. There was an orange on the ground. Nicole picked it up and put it into her pearl girl's dress pocket. Is she dead? I whispered. Don't know, said Nicole. Come on, we need to hurry. We reached the gate. We showed our passes. The angels let us out. Nicole was holding her cloak shut so no one would see that her pearls were missing. There was a black car farther up the street to the right, as Aunt Lydia had said there would be. The driver did not turn his head as we got in. All set, ladies, he said. I said, yes, thank you. But Nicole said, we're not ladies. I nudged her with my elbow. Don't talk to him like that, I whispered. He's not a real guardian, she said. Aunt Lydia's not a moron. She took the orange out of her pocket and began peeling it. The crisp scent of it filled the air. Want some? She asked me. You can have half. No, thank you, I said. It's not right to eat it. It had been a sacred offering of a kind, after all. She ate the whole orange. She'll make a misstep, I was thinking. Someone will notice. She'll get us arrested.
Transcript of Witness Testimony 369B. Chapter 62. I was feeling sorry that I'd punched Aunt Vidala, though not very sorry. If I hadn't hit her, she would have yelled and then we'd have been stopped. Even so, my heart was pounding. What if I'd actually killed her? But once they'd found her, dead or alive, there would be a hunt for us. We were in it up to the neck, as Ada would say. Meanwhile, Agnes was acting offended in that silent, pinched-mouth way the aunts had of letting you know you'd crossed one of their lines. Most likely it was the orange. Maybe I shouldn't have taken it. Then I had a bad thought. Dogs. Oranges are really scented. I started worrying about what to do with the peels. My left arm had begun to itch again, around the O. Why was it taking so long to heal? When Aunt Lydia was sticking the microdot into my arm, I thought her plan was brilliant. But now I felt it might not have been such a good idea. If my body and the message were one, what would happen if my body didn't make it to Canada? I could hardly cut off my arm and mail it. Our car went through a couple of checkpoints, passports, angels peering in the window to make sure we were us. But Agnes had told me to let the driver do the talking, and he did. Pearl Girls this and that, and how noble we were and what sacrifices we were making. At one of them, the angel said, "Good luck on your mission." At another one, farther out of town, they joked among themselves. "Hope they don't bring back any ugly girls or sluts. It's one or the other." Laughs from both checkpoint angels. Agnes put her hand on my arm. "Don't talk back," she said. When we'd reached the countryside and were on a highway, the driver handed us a couple of sandwiches, Gilead fake cheese. "I guess this is breakfast," I said to Agnes. "Toe jam on white." "We should give thanks," said Agnes in her pious aunt's voice, so I guess she was still in a snit. It was weird to think of her as my sister. We were so unlike. But I hadn't really had time to figure any of that out. "I'm glad to have a sister," I said, to make peace. "I'm glad too," said Agnes. "And I give thanks." But she didn't sound very thankful. "I give thanks too," I said, which was the end of that conversation. I thought of asking her how long we had to keep it up, this Gilead way of talking. Couldn't we stop and act natural now that we were escaping? But then, maybe for her it was natural. Maybe she didn't know another way. In Portsmouth, New Hampshire, the driver of our car let us out at the bus station. "Good luck, girls," he said. "Give 'em hell." "See? He's not a real guardian," I said, hoping to get Agnes talking again. "Of course not," she said. "A real guardian would never say hell." The bus station was old and crumbling. The women's washroom was a germ factory, and there was no place we could exchange our Gilead food tokens for anything a person would want. I was glad I'd eaten the orange. Agnes, however, was not squeamish, being used to the crap that passed for food at Ardua Hall, so she bought some kind of pretend donut with two of our tokens. The minutes were ticking. I was getting jittery. We waited and waited, and finally a bus did come. Some people on board nodded at us when we got on, as they might to the military, a salute of the head. An older econo-wife even said, "God bless you." About 10 miles along, there was another checkpoint, but the angels there were super polite to us. One of them said, "You're very brave, heading into Sodom." If I hadn't been so scared, I might have laughed. The idea of Canada being Sodom was hilarious, considering how boring and ordinary it mostly was. It wasn't like there was a non-stop countrywide orgy going on. Agnes squeezed my hand to tell me she would do the talking. She had the Ardua Hall knack of keeping her face flat and calm. "We are simply doing our service for Gilead," she said in her underspoken robot aunt's way, and the angel said, "Praise be." The ride got bumpier. They must have been keeping their road repair money for roads more people were likely to use, since trading with Canada was practically shut down nowadays. Who'd want to go to North Gilead unless you lived there? The bus wasn't full. Everyone on it was econo class. We were on the scenic route, winding along the coast. But it wasn't all that scenic. There were a lot of closed-down motels and roadside restaurants, and more than one big red smiling lobster that was falling apart. As we went north, the friendliness decreased. There were angry looks, and I had the feeling that our Pearl Girls mission and even the whole Gilead thing was leaking popularity. No one spat at us, but they scowled as if they would like to. I wondered how far we had come. Agnes had the map that had been marked up by Aunt Lydia, but I didn't like to ask her to take it out. The two of us looking at a map would be suspicious. The bus was slow, and I was getting more and more anxious. How soon before someone noticed we weren't in Ardua Hall? Would they believe my bogus note? Would they call ahead, set up a roadblock, stop the bus? We were so conspicuous. Then we took a detour, and it was one-way traffic, and Agnes started fidgeting with her hands. I nudged her with my elbow. We need to look serene, remember? She gave me a wan smile and folded her hands in her lap. I could feel her taking deep breaths and letting them out slowly. They did teach you a few useful things at Ardua Hall, and self-control was one of them. She who cannot control herself cannot control the path to duty. Do not fight the waves of anger. Use the anger as your fuel. Inhale. Exhale. Sidestep. Circumvent. Deflect. I would never have made it as a real aunt. It was around 5 in the afternoon when Agnes said, "We get off here." "Is this the border?" I said, and she said no. It was where we were supposed to meet our next ride. We took our backpacks off the rack and stepped down out of the bus. The town had boarded up storefronts and smashed windows, but there was a fuel station and a shabby convenience store. "This is encouraging," I said, gloomily. "Follow me and don't say anything," Agnes said. Inside, the store smelled like burnt toast and feet. There was hardly anything on the shelves, only a row of preserved food items with the lettering blacked out. Canned goods and crackers or cookies. Agnes went up to the coffee counter, one of those red ones with bar stools, and sat down, so I did the same. There was a dumpy, middle-aged Econo man working the counter. In Canada, it would have been a dumpy, middle-aged woman. "Yeah," the man said. Clearly, he wasn't impressed by our Pearl Girls' outfits. "Two coffees, please," said Agnes. He poured the coffees into mugs and shoved them across the counter. The coffee must have been sitting around all day because it was the worst I'd ever tasted, worse even than at Carpets. I didn't want to annoy the guy by not drinking it, so I put in a packet of sugar. If anything, that made it worse. "It's warm for a May day," said Agnes.
"It's not May," he said.
"Of course not," she said. "My mistake. There's a June moon." Now the guy was smiling.
"You need to use the washroom," he said. "Both of yous. It's through that door. I'll unlock it."
We went through the door. It wasn't a washroom. It was an outside shed, with old fishnets, a broken axe, a stack of buckets, and a back door.
"Don't know what took you so long," said the man. "Fucking bus, it's always late. Here's your new stuff. There's flashlights. Put your dresses in those backpacks. I'll dump them later. I'll be outside. We need to get a move on."
The clothes were jeans and long t-shirts and wool socks and hiking boots. Plaid jackets, fleece pull-on hats, waterproof jackets. I had a little trouble with the left t-shirt sleeve. Something caught on the O. I said, "Fucking shit." And then, "Sorry." I don't think I've ever changed clothes so fast in my life. But once I got the silver dress off and those clothes on, I began to feel more like myself.
Transcript of Witness Testimony 369A. Chapter 63.
I found the clothing provided for us disagreeable in the extreme. The underwear was very different from the plain, sturdy variety worn at Ardua Hall. To me, it felt slippery and depraved. Over that, there were male garments. It was disturbing to feel that rough cloth touching the skin of my legs with no intervening petticoat. Wearing such clothing was gender treachery and against God's law. Last year, a man had been hanged on the wall for dressing in his wife's undergarments. She'd discovered him and turned him in, as was her duty. I have to take these off, I said to Nicole. They're men's garments. No, they're not, she said. Those are girls' jeans. They're cut differently. And look at the little silver cupids. Definitely girls. They'd never believe that in Gilead, I said. I'd be flogged, or worse. Gilead, said Nicole, is not where we're going. We've got 2 minutes to join our buddy outside, so suck it up. Pardon? Sometimes I could not make out what my sister was saying. She laughed a little. It means be brave, she said. We are going to a place where she will understand the language, I thought. And I will not. The man had a battered pickup. The three of us squashed into the front seat. It was beginning to drizzle. Thank you for all you are doing for us, I said. The man grunted. I get paid, he said. For putting my neck in the noose. I'm too old for this. The driver must have been drinking while we were changing our clothes. I could smell the alcohol. I remembered that smell from the dinner parties Commander Kyle would have when I was young. Rosa and Vera used to finish up what was left in the glasses sometimes. Scylla, not as much. Now that I was about to leave Gilead forever, I was feeling homesick for Scylla and Rosa and Vera, and for my former home, and for Tabitha. In those early times, I was not motherless, but now I felt that I was. Aunt Lydia had been a mother of sorts, although a harsh one, and I would not see her again. Aunt Lydia had told Nicole and me that our real mother was alive and waiting for us in Canada. But I wondered if I would die on the way there. If so, I would never meet her at all in this life. Right then, she was only a torn-up picture. She was an absence, a gap inside me. Despite the alcohol, the man drove well and quickly. The road was winding and slick because of the drizzle. The miles went by. The moon had risen above the clouds, silvering the black outlines of the treetops. There was the occasional house, either dark or with only a few lights on. I made a conscious effort to quell my anxieties. Then I fell asleep. I dreamed of Becca. She was there beside me in the front of the truck. I couldn't see her, though I knew she was there. I said to her in the dream, "So you came with us after all. I'm so happy." But she didn't answer.
Transcript of Witness Testimony 369B. Chapter 64. The night slid by in silence. Agnes was asleep, and the guy driving was not what you'd call talkative. I guess he thought of us as cargo to be delivered. And whoever talked to the cargo? After a while, we turned down a narrow side road. Water glinted ahead. We pulled in beside what looked like a private dock. There was a motorboat with someone sitting in it. "Wake her up," the driver said. "Take your stuff. There's your boat." I poked Agnes in the ribs and she started awake. "Rise and shine," I said. "What time is it?" "Boat time. Let's go,"
Have a good trip, said our driver. Agnes started thanking him some more, but he cut her off. He tossed our new backpacks out of the truck and was gone before we were halfway to the boat. I was using my flashlight so we could see the path.
Turn out the light,
the person in the boat called softly. It was a man, wearing a waterproof with the hood up, but the voice sounded young.
You can see okay. Take it slow. Sit on the middle seat.
Is this the ocean?
Agnes asked. He laughed.
Not yet, he said. This is the Penobscot River. You'll get to the ocean soon enough.
The motor was electric and very quiet. The boat went right down the middle of the river. There was a crescent moon, and the water was reflecting it.
Look, Agnes whispered. I've never seen anything so beautiful. It's like a trail of light.
At that moment, I felt older than her. We were almost outside Gilead now, and the rules were changing. She was going to a new place where she wouldn't know how things were done. But I was going home.
We're right out in the open. What if anyone sees us?
I asked the man.
What if they tell them? The eyes.
People around here don't talk to the eyes, he said. We don't like snoops.
Are you a smuggler? I said, remembering what Ada had told me.
My sister nudged me.
Bad manners again. You avoided blunt questions in Gilead. He laughed.
Borders. Lines on a map. Things move across. People too. I'm just the delivery boy.
The river got wider and wider. The mist was rising. The shores were vague.
There she is,
the man said finally. I could see a darker shadow out on the water.
The Nellie J. Banks. Your ticket to paradise.
Part 23. Wall.
The Ardua Hall Holograph. Chapter 65. Aunt Vidala was discovered lying behind my statue in a comatose condition by elderly Aunt Clover and two of her septuagenarian gardeners. The conclusion the paramedics came to was that she'd had a stroke, a diagnosis confirmed by our doctors. Rumors spread round Ardua Hall. Sad shakes of the head were exchanged, and prayers for Aunt Vidala's recovery were promised. A broken pearl girl's necklace was found in the vicinity. Someone must have lost it at some point. A wasteful oversight. I will issue a memorandum about vigilance in regard to those material objects it is our duty to safeguard. Pearls do not grow on trees, I will say, even artificial ones, nor should they be cast before swine. Not that there are any swine at Ardua Hall, I will add coyly. I paid Aunt Vidala a visit in the intensive care unit. She was lying on her back with her eyes closed, and a tube going into her nose and another one going into her arm. How is our dear Aunt Vidala? I asked the nursing aunt on duty. I have been praying for her, said Aunt something. I can never remember the names of the nurses. It is their fate. She's in a coma. That may aid the healing process. There may be some paralysis. They're afraid her speech might be affected. If she recovers, I said. When she recovers, the nurse said reproachfully. We don't like to voice anything negative within the hearing of our patients. They may appear to be asleep, but frequently they are fully aware. I sat beside Vidala until the nurse had gone. Then I made a rapid inspection of the pharmaceutical aids available. Should I up the anesthetic, tamper with the tube feeding into her arm, pinch off her oxygen supply? I did none of these. I believe in effort, but not in unnecessary effort. Aunt Vidala was most likely negotiating her exit from this world all on her own. Before leaving the intensive care unit, I pocketed a small vial of morphine, foresight being a cardinal virtue. While we were taking our lunchtime places in the refectory, Aunt Helena commented on the absence of Aunt Victoria and Aunt Immortelle. "I believe they are fasting," I said. "I glimpsed them in the Hildegard Library reading room yesterday, studying their Bibles. They are hoping for guidance during their upcoming mission." "Commendable," said Aunt Helena. She continued her discreet head-counting. "Where is our new convert, Jade?" "Perhaps she is ill," I said. "A female complaint." "I will go and see," said Aunt Helena. "Perhaps she needs a hot water bottle. Doorway C, is it?" "How kind of you," I said. "Yes, I believe hers is the garret room on the third floor." I hoped Nicole had left her elopement note in a prominent location. Aunt Helena hurried back from her visit to doorway C, giddy with the excitement of her discovery. The girl Jade had eloped. "With a plumber named Garth," Aunt Helena added. "She claims to be in love." "That is unfortunate," I said. "We shall have to locate the pair, administer a reprimand, and make sure that the marriage has been properly performed." "But Jade is very uncouth. She would not have made a reputable aunt." "Look on the bright side. The population of Gilead may well be augmented by this union." "But how could she have met such a plumber?" said Aunt Elizabeth. "There was a complaint about a lack of bath water this morning from doorway A," I said. "They must have called in the plumber. Clearly it was love at first sight. Young people are impetuous." "No one in the hall is supposed to take baths in the morning," said Aunt Elizabeth, "unless someone has been breaking the rules." "That is not out of the question, unfortunately," I said. "The flesh is weak." "Oh, yes, so weak," Aunt Helena agreed. "But how did she get out through the gate? She doesn't have a pass. It wouldn't have been allowed." "Girls of that age are very agile," I said. "I expect she climbed over the wall." We continued with lunch, dry sandwiches and something ruinous that had been done to tomatoes, and a dessert of René Blancmange, and by the end of our humble meal, the girl Jade's premature flight, her acrobatic feat of wall climbing, and her headstrong choice to fulfill her womanly destiny in the arms of an enterprising economan plumber were general knowledge among us.
Part 24. The Nellie J. Banks.
Transcript of Witness Testimony 369B. Chapter 66. We pulled up beside the ship. On the deck were three shadows. A flashlight shone briefly. We climbed up the rope ladder.
"Sit on the edge. Swing your feet over," said a voice.
Someone took my arm. Then we were standing on the deck.
"Captain Misha Mango," said the voice. "Let's get you inside."
There was a low hum and I felt the ship moving. We went into a little cabin with blackout curtains on the windows and some controls and what was likely a ship's radar, though I didn't have a chance to look at it closely.
"Glad you made it," said Captain Misha Mango.
He shook our hands. He had two fingers missing. He was stocky, about 60, with tan skin and a short black beard.
"Now here's our story, supposing you're asked. This is a cod schooner, solar, with fuel backup. Flag of convenience is Lebanon. We've delivered a cargo of cod and lemons by special license, which means the gray market, and now we're heading back out. You'll need to stay out of sight during the day. I heard from my contact, via Bert, who dropped you at the dock, that they're bound to be looking for you soon. There's a place for you to sleep in the hold. If there's an inspection, Coast Guard, it won't be thorough. It's guys we know."
He rubbed his fingers together, which I knew meant money. "Have you got any food?" I asked. "We haven't eaten much all day."
"Right," he said.
He told us to wait there and came back with a couple mugs of tea and some sandwiches. They were cheese, but it wasn't Gilead cheese. It was real cheese. Goat cheese with chives. A kind Melanie had liked.
"Thank you," said Agnes.
I'd started eating, but I mumbled thanks with my mouth full. "Your friend Ada says hello, and see you soon," Captain Misha Mango said to me.
I swallowed.
How do you know Ada?
He laughed. Everyone's related, around here anyways. We used to go deer hunting in Nova Scotia together, back in the day.
We reached our sleeping place by going down a ladder. Captain Mishi Mango went first, turning on the lights. There were some freezers in the hold and some big oblong metal boxes. On the side of one of the boxes was a hinged flap, and inside were two sleeping bags that didn't look very clean. I guess we weren't the first people to use them. The whole place smelled of fish.
You can keep the box door open as long as there's no problems, said Captain Mishi Mango. Sleep tight. Don't let the bugs bite.
We heard his steps receding.
This is kind of awful, I whispered to Agnes. The fish smell? These sleeping bags? I bet they have lice.
We should be grateful, she said. Let's go to sleep. My God love tattoo was bothering me, and I had to lie on my right side to avoid squashing it. I wondered if I had blood poisoning. If so, I was in trouble because there was definitely not a doctor on board. We woke up when it was still dark because the ship was rocking. Agnes climbed out of our metal box and went up the ladder to see what was happening. I wanted to go too, but I really wasn't feeling well. She came back down with a thermos of tea and two hard-boiled eggs. We'd reached the ocean, she said, and the waves were rocking the ship. She'd never imagined waves that big, though Captain Mishi Mango said they were nothing much.
Oh, God, I said. I hope they won't get any bigger. I hate throwing up.
Please do not use the name of God as a casual swear word, she said.
Sorry, I said. But if you don't mind me saying, supposing there is a God, he has totally effed up my life.
I thought she'd get angry then, but all she said was, You are not unique in the universe. No one has an easy time in life. But maybe God has effed up, as you put it, your life for a reason.
And I can hardly fucking wait to find out what that is, I said.
The pain in my arm was making me very irritable. I shouldn't have been so sarcastic, and I shouldn't have sworn at her.
But I thought you grasped the true goal of our mission, she said. The salvation of Gilead. The purification. The renewal. That is the reason.
You think that festering shit heap can be renewed? I said. Burn it all down.
Why would you want to harm so many people? She asked, gently. It's my country. It's where I grew up. It's being ruined by the leaders. I want it to be better.
Yeah, okay, I said. I get it.
Sorry, I didn't mean you. You're my sister. I accept your apology, she said. Thank you for understanding. We sat in the dark silence for a few minutes. I could hear her breathing and a few sighs. You think this is going to work? I asked, finally. Will we get there? It's not in our hands, she said.
Transcript of Witness Testimony 369A Chapter 67 By the beginning of our second day, I was very worried about Nicole. She claimed she wasn't ill, but she had a fever. I recalled what we'd been taught at Ardua Hall about caring for the sick, and I attempted to keep her hydrated. There were some lemons on board, and I was able to mix some of their juice with tea and salt and a little sugar. I was finding it easier now to go up and down the ladder that led to our sleeping quarters, and reflected that it would have been much harder in a long skirt. It was quite foggy. We were still in Gileadian waters, and around noon there was a Coast Guard inspection. Nicole and I shut the door of our metal box from the inside. She took hold of my hand, and I squeezed it hard, and we stayed absolutely quiet. We heard footsteps tramping around and voices, but the sounds dwindled and my heart stopped beating so quickly. Later that day, there was engine trouble, which I discovered when I went up for more lemon juice. Captain Mishi Mango seemed worried. The tides in this region were very high and fast, he said, and without power, we'd be swept out to sea, or else we'd be drawn into the Bay of Fundy and wrecked on the Canadian shore, and the ship would be impounded and the crew arrested. The ship was drifting south. Did this mean we would be taken right back into Gilead? I wondered if Captain Mishi Mango was wishing he hadn't agreed to take us. He told me that if the ship should be pursued and captured, and we were found, he'd be accused of woman smuggling. His ship would be seized, and since he himself was originally from Gilead and had escaped from the Gilead national homelands via the Canadian border, they'd claim him as a citizen and put him on trial as a smuggler, and that would be the end of him. "We're putting you in too much danger," I said when I heard this. "Don't you have an arrangement with the Coast Guard about the gray market?"
"They deny it. There's nothing in writing," he said. "Who wants to be shot for taking bribes?"
For supper, there were chicken sandwiches, but Nicole wasn't hungry and wanted